Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a perfect storm of political dysfunction brewing in Pakistan, where the Supreme Court has just called for the arrest of the Prime Minister, and a fundamentalist preacher is leading a horde marching on the capital, while all around the country, minority Shia are conducting sit-in protests against a government that does not protect them from religious violence meted out by murderous Sunni fanatics. An expert on Pakistan who speaks the local languages, Christine Fair, joins us to discuss a country whose neighbour India is accusing of trying to start another war. Then we'll look into the warning by the rating agency Fitch that it may downgrade US debt in another self-inflicted crisis over the debt ceiling that calls into question the predictability and reliability of the handling of the nation's fiscal affairs. William Cohan, a contributing editor at Fortune and the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, joins us to discuss whether Wall Street, who gave the bulk of their money to Republicans in the last election, will be able to exert pressure or sufficient pressure on their political hirelings to ensure enough adult behavior to avoid a government default. Then finally, following the president's re-election victory, helped by an overwhelming vote from women, we will discuss the deficit of women in the new Obama cabinet with Michelle Kinsey-Bruns, who is the online manager for the Women's Media Center. They have launched a petition to urge Obama to appoint more women in senior positions, particularly at the FCC, to address the paucity of women in the all-white, all-male top management circles of America's mainstream media. Joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who was a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again.
And when I suggest a perfect storm, it does seem that all of the sort of political dysfunction in Pakistan, which is sort of there beneath the surface, is all coming to the surface now with the Prime Minister calling, with the Supreme Court calling for the arrest of the Prime Minister, and this preacher leading this march on the Capitol, and the Shia sit-in protests. And then on top of that, you have the Prime Minister of India basically saying that Pakistan's military are trying to cause trouble to prevent any peaceful advances between the two countries and perhaps start another war. So let's start with the big picture, India versus Pakistan. What did you make of Prime Minister Singh's accusations towards Pakistan?
Well, so in the big picture, what we have seen between India and Pakistan has actually been quite a bit of rapprochement. There have been unprecedented economic agreements. Pakistan finally agreed to issue India the most favored nation status, something which India had actually offered Pakistan decades ago. And they were actually making movement on that front. They also had agreed to relax visa regime so that you could have more people-to-people contact between the two countries. I, for one, have always been very dubious that the military would simply set back and let this rapprochement carry forward, because what primarily secures the army's right to take over the country whenever it wants, and as well as to commandeer the resources per its wishes, is this competition with India. Now, what actually happened was the Indian troops did cross into Pakistani territory across the line of control. I don't think there's any contest there. But the problem, of course, is that one of the Indians was actually beheaded by Pakistani army personnel. And obviously, that's just a whole kind of illegal. We haven't really seen the Pakistan army engage in this kind of brazen flouting of international law since the 1971 war, when it was very repressive, rapacious, and brutal to its own population in East Pakistan.
So, but there's a pattern here, isn't there? The Mumbai attacks happened on the eve of the first meeting between the foreign ministers of Pakistan and India. And again, this visa requirement, or relaxing the visa requirement to have a visa on arrival program for senior citizens from Pakistan, now that's been put on hold. So, excuse my suspicions, but I see a pattern here.
No, I mean, of course, the difference is that those previous things have all been disrupted by a terrorist attack. I mean, this is really, that's sort of like the standard operating procedure, is that there's this important rapprochement, and then there's a terrorist attack in India by a group with ties to Pakistani intelligence. But this is really different. I mean, you had a Pakistani soldier behead an Indian soldier. This is, I mean, so this is not done by a terrorist organization. This is actually done by an army that the American government likes to say repeatedly is a professional military organization. Now, we can quibble with that distinction because, after all, professional military organizations don't stage coups whenever it feels like it. But the very fact that there's absolutely no demand for punishment of this individual who beheaded this Indian soldier is really quite extraordinary. This is a really new low for the Pakistan Army.
Well, of course, there's always been the expression that Pakistan is a country, not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And a lot of people are very suspicious about this preacher who's marching on the capital and demanding that his followers are able to sit in front of the parliament. Some people are suggesting that this is yet another a kind of stealth activity on the part of the military, since this preacher is sort of approved, is he not? I mean, he's against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but he's also essentially attacking the Pakistan People's Party and corruption in government. So to what extent is this, as is the case or has been the suggestion with the cricket star, that he was also a stealth candidate for the military?
Well, I very much am of the belief that that's the case. So one thing that you'll notice, the activism of the Supreme Court against the PPP is almost always correlated with the prospects of an alternative political power. So you would, if you followed some of the shenanigans of the Supreme Court against the PPP last year, we're looking at Memogate, we're looking at the impeachment or the removal of Gilani because he refused to reinstate some of the criminal proceedings against Zardari and send a letter asking the Swiss to do the same. The Supreme Court is galvanized to attack the PPP only when there appears to be an alternative on the horizon. Now, last year, the potential alternative was Imran Khan, and he was able to produce very large crowds, and everyone suspected that he was able to do so with the help of the army. So why would the Supreme Court coincide? Why would his activism with the PPP coincide with those alternatives? And the reason is very simple. The current Supreme Court Justice Chaudhary cannot stand the PPP. However, the army, which also dislikes the PPP tremendously, has absolutely no use for its primary and only political rival, the Pakistan Muslim League under Nawaz Sharif. Recall, he was the one that tried to kill Musharraf. So any interest in destabilizing the PPP without bringing into play the equities of the Pakistan Muslim League under Nawaz Sharif has to involve a third party. And after after Imran Khan proved himself to be a completely unworthy vessel of the army's interests as well as the Supreme Court's interests, we now see this new fellow. And what's so interesting about him is he came out of nowhere. He had lived his life peacefully in Canada. He literally came out of nowhere. And the crowds that he's drawing are really unprecedented. And when you see crowds this big in Pakistan, it's not like Tahrir Square in Egypt. These are almost always orchestrated through the fine services of Pakistan's intelligence agencies. The fact that he has gotten so much money to plaster his publicity campaign all over the place also raises suspicions. Recall that only a few weeks ago, a former director general of the ISI, Asad Durrani, already confessed to using massive millions of dollars, actually, of ISI funds to manipulate electoral candidacy in the 90s. So this is something the army has long done. And so I think the suspicion, the timing of Qadri's enormous crowds, his ability to have such publicity funds, and I'll add something else that's kind of interesting. This fellow has been disporting about in this basically shaheed-proof container. I ask the question, how can some fellow who spent most of his life in Pakistan have the wherewithal to find with such expediency anyone that could fashion a bomb-proof, bullet-proof container, and then, of course, secure all the necessary approvals to do what he's done? It seems impossible to me that this has taken place without the manipulation of Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI.
And Christine Fair, again, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan. She's now a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Given that there are these suspicions about these messiahs that come out of nowhere and seem to have the support behind the scenes of the ISI, and they throw all that money around, how much of that money, by the way, is from the U.S. taxpayer? Because the U.S. taxpayer has over the decades supported the Pakistan military up until, you know, the Kerry Lugar bill tried to, you know, give a little bit of money to the civilian side.
I mean, that's hard to say. Money's fungible. So, I mean, I don't want to speculate, but obviously every billion we give the Pakistanis, it frees up a billion of their own resources to do what they want. But I think the real question is, what can actually come from these instant messiahs? And I'm of the view, I mean, right now, if elections are held as they're expected to, it's going to be a really important transition. It'll actually be the second sitting parliament that served its term out without being prorogued, and it will be the first that's done so under a complete civilian dispensation. And many analysts, including myself, see that this is a really important turning point for Pakistan to really have democratic institutions take root and fructify. So it would make the ability of the army to intervene in such a drastic way increasingly less possible. And so I think the army is looking at this transition with a little bit of concern. I don't think the army really wants to let go of its ability to manipulate Pakistan's domestic politics. Yet, I think it also knows that the Pakistani public, they're not going to tolerate any disruption in the election. They're not going to tolerate a military coup. So what the army's left with is trying to calibrate as best as it can the political arrangement to its preferences. I don't think that the PPP is going to be defeated. Despite, you know, Americans see the corruption, we see the protests, I think there's a degree of orchestration. But what the PPP has actually done, despite all of its faults, and they are numerous, it's actually done more than any other government to solidify democratic institutions. It's the only president, Zardari, though he is a deeply problematic fellow. He did sign the 18th Amendment, which devolved almost all of his presidential powers to the prime minister. And he devolved power from the center to the provinces. These have been really important strides that don't get a lot of play in the Western media because we're so focused on Pakistan, the failures, not Pakistan, the success. So I would not be surprised if the PPP manages to eke out a majority of the votes. So what the army is trying to do is to weaken the PPP so that it will have to come into power with a coalition, and preferably, from the army's point of view, a coalition of its stooges. And that may be the best way to keep a rein on the PPP while also keeping politics fragile. And that way, if the government does fall apart because it was incoherent to begin with, it will not be blamed on the army, but rather incompetent politics. And so I think that might be the end game that the army is playing for. I think that's the best it can hope for, given the absolute intolerance for further army manipulation explicitly in Pakistan's governance.
And it does seem that the PPP have responded at least in part to the outrage amongst the Shiite minority in the country, who were angered by a suicide bombing that killed more than 90 Shiites in Quetta last week. There have been sit-ins all across the country, including not burying the dead and having the coffins lie out there against the Islamic tradition. And finally, Zardari's administration did agree to their demands in ousting the government in Balochistan province, where the bombing took place. So is that an example, you think, of this government being more responsive?
Well, so the Shia problem is much more complicated than this government. The Pakistan Taliban has always relied upon sectarian militias. And so as you've seen the Pakistan Taliban become more powerful, And being able to resist the writ of the Pakistani state, you've seen the sectarian groups become all the more brazen in the violence that they commit. The group in Balochistan that are particularly vulnerable are Hazaras. So they are both an ethnic minority with ties to Afghanistan. And in addition to that, they're Shia. But if you look at the data, sectarian violence has really seized Pakistan. And it's escalated just as the TTP has consolidated its position. And in fact, what you see now, Imran Khan, obviously the army, the PMLN, and the TTP has actually not been as bold as they should be. Everyone's trying to find a way of placating the TTP. That's the Pakistan Taliban. They hope that when the Americans are gone from Afghanistan, they will go and join the Taliban there to fight the Northern Alliance, leaving the Pakistanis alone. And so everyone's kind of hoping on this one solution. And so in point of fact, there's no quick fix to this, the killing of Shia, because it's so intrinsically tied to Pakistan's support of the Afghan Taliban, as well as its inability to manage the Pakistan Taliban, because it also has ties to other militant groups that are tools of the state, like for example, Jaish-e-Mohammed that targets India. So there is not going to be a ready solution to what is, I think, a genocide of Shia in Pakistan.
But just in closing, in the last couple of minutes, Chris Fair, it would seem, though, that the Pakistani military and the government, to a lesser extent, have a tiger by the tail with their own Taliban. If they think that they can export them into Afghanistan to help the Afghan Taliban fight the Northern Alliance, if they are successful and they don't fight to a draw, which it seems more likely, won't that have blowback? I mean, the idea that you get, you know, the Saudis have been exporting their troublemakers forever, and that led to bin Laden. But bin Laden's also famous for his blowback.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that I find so frustrating with the Pakistanis on the main, in both the political discourse as well as the news discourse on Pakistan's various media channels, there's no responsibility for this current situation. They park the current internal security problems at the fault of the United States. The fact is, the Pakistan Taliban would not exist had the Pakistanis not had, it's not a decade history, it doesn't go back to 89, it goes back to 47. They've been nurturing and raising Islamist jihadis since 1947. The violence that Pakistan is currently suffering is blowback. And you will find very little acknowledgement of this in Pakistan's political class, certainly not in the army. And if you watch some of the Pakistani Urdu television, as I do, as well as follow some of the key opinion makers on social media, they want to blame all of this on the Americans. And I think that the Pakistanis are going to continue to be in for one rude awakening after another. If they succeed to have their plans work out in Afghanistan, where the Taliban are back in play, they're going to have more of this violence, not less. And this is something that Pakistanis are going to have to wake up to. You can tell them, you can explain it to them, but the Pakistanis have their own narrative about what's in their interest and who's actually threatening them. And I think, to say sort of in conclusion, what Pakistanis are really fed a lot of misinformation from their own intelligence agencies. If you listen to who Pakistanis blame for the Shia violence, for some of the TTP violence, they blame the Americans, they blame the Indians, they blame the Israelis, they blame Blackwater. And so there is this complete ossified fiction that makes reckoning with the problem almost impossible in the near term.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Chris Fair.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Fitch threatening to downgrade U.S.'s credit rating.